The very idea of politics intimidates many of us, let alone trying to work out where Christianity fits in. I'm guessing there'll probably be one or two here who are quite practiced in political engagement, but most won't be. And that's okay, there's nothing wrong with that. In a sense, tonight is for you, if you're not as practiced. We'll go through in five sections tonight. We'll just talk about politics generally, what on earth we might even mean by that term. I want to talk about some political passages in the Bible. There's lots in the Bible that has a political bent, and I'm going to just pick on five of the most famous passages and talk about those a little bit. Then a simple picture of what we do, and by we I'm talking very broadly about the Christian community, which of course is a sprawling and diverse bunch. Then diving a little more deeply to talk about some styles of engagement that some Christians, that various Christians deploy. And finally, if you're hearing all this and thinking about what would I do to become involved, we'll talk about the kinds of involvement, the degrees of involvement that people can have in the political process. So, the first one, politics. At its simplest, I think that it's just easiest to think of politics as concerning life in a group, living in groups. And if you find politics hard to think about, just try this one on for size and see if it helps. Our first experience of it actually happens, I think, when we struggle to get a parent's attention, maybe against the demands of a sibling. It happens in families, in other words, right from the get-go. That manoeuvring and that positioning we do to get noticed and heard, a haggling we do when a parent makes a rule, that lobbying we do when we want to influence mum or dad in some direction. Some people think that that is politics, pure and simple, right there, right before your eyeballs, right from your earliest waking awareness of what it is to be a social person. Now, of course, most families aren't just political, are they? Most families putter along with this funny mix of grudging love and fierce loyalty and petty low-grade conflict and competition. Now, would it be right to call all of that politics? Some do. Some say that politics is the personal. Politics is the personal. By which I think they mean that all relationships, each and every one of our relationships, has a political edge. At the base of family life are these relationships, perhaps loving, perhaps reconciled after some breakdown, perhaps highly conflicted, perhaps very broken. And to call all that politics actually might sound a bit wrong, mightn't it? Because it sounds too calculating. We've learnt to think of politics as being something where you manoeuvre to get what you want. And that sounds a bit selfish, and selfishness destroys love. But of course, you could be political, couldn't you, in a family without selfishness? You could engage in what we might call political advocacy. When you notice that your little sister or brother never gets a fair deal, and their parents either don't know it, or can't act, or don't care. In that case, you could call it political the way you try and get their attention, get them to see and feel things differently, and the way you might propose solutions. But historically, I guess, people have been reluctant to call what goes on in families political. More usually, politics describes what goes on out there in public, and it stops on the threshold of the home. In a family, a lot happens without us thinking too hard about it, precisely because of that grudging mix of loyalty and love. Kinship comes wide into us. And so much of what carries us through family life just happens beneath our awareness, but not so out there in public, where you find neighbours and strangers. Because, I mean, what did your mum have to do? Your mum had to teach you what to do in a shop. Your dad has his ideas about how to respond to aggression. They show you how to be amongst strangers in a library or in a waiting line. You're inducted into all of these social conventions that help the wider group beyond the family to function. And you gradually become aware that threaded throughout all of that are people who run things. You become aware of various authority figures, principals, police, teachers, that kind of person. You might try some of those moves that worked in your family with these people, but you learn that they don't really always work and that these people don't necessarily love you and that various punishments occur if you always do what you want. And so, on the back of that, a very ancient definition calls politics the art of rule. The art of rule. It's about what gives people their authority to run things, to make you do things, and to limit or punish you in various ways. And a lot of people have no need or interest to go beyond that when they think about politics. Beyond my family, there are authorities that I'm forced to navigate, and 99% of the time I don't need to think about them. I might have a hurdle to jump if, say, I don't know, I'm caught shoplifting, or if I want to extend my house and I have to wrangle over with the council over a development application. If I run a business, there are state and federal laws I comply with, and if I work for a bad boss, I might have to draw on those laws and draw them to his or her attention, or maybe call in some other authority. But on the whole, most Australians don't really care about why others rule them. They just do. These people who run things are just there in the landscape, like rocks and trees, and you have to get along around them. But what if, and by this stage I guess I'm talking about people in their 20s and 30s, what if I start to wonder? What if I start to ask that Barry O'Farrell, that Julia Gillard, what makes them think that they should run things? Or what makes Tony Abbott think that he can do it better? In Australia, we have compulsory voting, which is actually quite unusual on the world scene. I don't know if you're aware of this, but we're a bit odd. And so most of us don't vote because we've thought about the merits of Julia or Tony. Most of us just want to avoid the $50 fine. And again, we're simply, what are we doing at that point? We're simply navigating our way around the demand of another authority, like just another rock on the ground. But every so often, some of us try. We might tune into Q&A or read some blogs or opinion pieces and try and get a grip on why they are fighting over this or that policy. Refugee policy, tax policy, withdrawal from Afghanistan, national disability insurance, same-sex marriage, how to have better public transport, care for the ageing. The moment you dip your toe in, you find these difficult, competing proposals about how we can all have a better life together. And this roar of opinion is gradually going to have to settle into something. It's going to have to settle into laws and policies that give authorities their authority. And when you think about it, it was discussions precisely like that in a former generation which gave the teacher, the principal, the police person their power over you. We could call this politics public affairs. And we get the terms left and right, I guess, from these discussions. Back in the day, those who wanted society run one way sat on the left of, actually, the French Parliament. Did you know this is where it comes from? They sat on the left of the French Parliament and their opponents sat on the right. And we've stolen these terms as a very broad label for two different clusters of opinions about how we should be together. I'm going to oversimplify here, but here it is. Left versus right. The left says, well, government should take the lead. It should uphold human rights, regulate markets and redistribute wealth, should support the vulnerable, and it should promote a diversity of family forms. Government should use its power to solve problems, effect justice for the weak, and change things for the better. That's roughly the left. The right says governments should back off and actually leave us alone as much as they can, and society should lead. Society should do its thing with government interfering as little as possible. Let business do business. Let religion say almost whatever they want. Let the vulnerable sort themselves out, although we won't stop others in the community helping them. And let families do what they've always done. Now, I put that very simplistically. When you try and badge someone as left or right, it doesn't really work because we can be left on some issues and right on others. Indeed, some people think these terms left and right are so worn out as to be useless. In Australian politics, the Liberal Party is supposed to be the right and the Labor Party is supposed to be left, but on most issues their differences are minuscule. But I just throw these terms left and right into the mix to show how people get to a place where their politics has a view on how we should live together, and it's far more to them than just I'm avoiding or responding to authority. But depending on how you're wired, you might then have another train of thought that goes beyond all of that, that goes beyond this notion of public affairs. What if you began to wonder how it all got here in the first place? After all, this vast group called Australia functions very differently than how the original inhabitants did things. Back in the day, before white settlement, Indigenous people comprised some 240 nations, we might call them, across Australia. And the way life was conducted within those nations was very different to what we do. They still did the basics, like childbearing within marriage, but if you asked them a question like, how do you relate to strangers, you would hear that there are no strangers in our nation because we're all kin. If you asked who runs them, you would hear about some local elders, but never about any one elder attempting to span as vast a region as Barry O'Farrell does or Julia Gillard does. And never in a zillion years would it cross their mind or seem interesting to them or seem important to them to pack up their young men in boats and attack or defend people on the other side of the world as we regularly do. That's just a completely different way of thinking about their life together. So what happened? How do things get to be the way they do? How do we get things like we do? If you grew up in Australia, you probably did that obligatory trip to Canberra in year six. And you have some vague memory of the Green Chamber and the Red Chamber, something about there being a constitution with three arms of government. Some dude with a black stick gets involved. And there's, you know, those gallery with all the prime ministers on the walls. You go and have a milkshake and get lost in Canberra because the teacher can't find where the roads go. And you know, most of us are just left with this vague notion of the machinery of government. But why? Why all that? Where did it come from? Why a parliament and ministers of departments and courts? Why don't we have a military strongman like Bashar al-Assad in Syria? Why don't we have a communist party and state-run capitalism like in China? You see, people around the world dream up these various ways of running themselves. It seems that there are as many ways of running a group as there are groups. The Greek philosopher Aristotle was so fascinated by this that he studied, I think it was about 180 of the Greek city-states at the time, to try and get a sense of how they all did business and to try and distill from it whether there were any common patterns among them as to how to do things best, and he wrote a whole book about it. Let's return to this list. The main point I'm making is twofold. That first, we might simply take a step back from what we take for granted and simply try and understand it all. And that's what we might call political philosophy or political science. And few of us, I guess, are going to arrive at that level of knowledge. But second, and this does apply to all of us, politics is actually an act of what we might call collective imagination. An act of collective imagination. Our imagination, what we find thinkable about how to live together, what we find thinkable and defensible, has been shaped by the polity in which we grow up. Polity is a word that describes both how we do things and the reasons that we give for doing them. So in our context, we're almost all what you call politically liberal. We think that no one should be able to make anyone do anything that you don't want to, except if it can be shown that you'll hurt someone if you go ahead. In our polity, the teacher, the police person, and Julia Gillard are all expected to show how their authority functions within that basic premise. They can't just tell us to do whatever they feel like. So just to begin with, like I said, we're trying to keep start simple. Just to begin with, here are these four ways that are helpful, I find, to think about politics. And I've also highlighted on the right there some words that can be helpful as we pick our way through. Words like advocacy, public, authority, law, policy, left, right, policy, political, philosophy. What these are getting at can be helpful and important. But I'm reluctant to say too much more about those just yet because for some of us it already makes our head hurt. I interviewed a few friends before tonight just to say, look, where do you reckon people will be at when they arrive on politics tonight? And they reminded me of my own weird childhood trip to Canberra. Well, actually I didn't go on one. Somehow the teacher was so checked out that we never got around to it, and she didn't even seem to have the slightest clue what the red and the blue room were all about. And, you know, all I knew about politics is that the politicians are very, very boring. That was the sum total of my knowledge. My father was from a poor family and then became a self-employed builder. So he had this funny mix of left and right in his head. Mother never talked about it. And things would perplex me. I remember I used to, you know, discover that politicians had these conscience votes. Now, you don't hear much of these now, but this is when a member of parliament stops voting along with his or her party and votes according to what he or she thinks is right. And I couldn't work out what that meant for all of their other votes. I just suppose it must have meant that all their other votes were done without conscience or unconsciously. And I mean, neither really actually sounded very good, sounded very reassuring. My friends also, as I was having this discussion about where you guys might be at, my friends also reminded me that to be politically engaged, whatever that is, sounds very tiring. We might become aware of some issue that adversely affects us, like the carbon tax driving up your power costs. But that's about it. The people whom we meet that are politically engaged seem either passionate and smart or just really bullish and wearying. And they're never on about the same thing. One intense person is hassling us about refugee policy. The next is trying to get us on board for or against same-sex marriage. And another is trying to get us to join a union and raise the minimum wage. And someone else wants us to fight abortion or for business deregulation or for more public housing. And on it goes. I mean, how'd they get like this? Maybe they come from families who always talked about this stuff. Maybe they work in sectors that give them knowledge. But most of us don't have a clue how to be like them. And we're not sure if we can or should care. And even if we could make ourselves care, we don't know what to do next. So I simply want to acknowledge that. I'll go on to say that there are those who actually can't care about politics and might not be wired to participate. And it really is okay to sit back tonight and think of it all as a sightseeing tour. And apologies if you came expecting me to rev up a wave of young advocates for your thing. I'm not going to do that. I want simply to just keep pushing on the door for people who feel like they're on the outside of something, looking in and they don't understand. So far then, I've simply tried to build a list of how our awareness about politics might expand over the years. And I've acknowledged how many people's awareness fades quite early on that list. Actually, I don't even want you to make too many value judgments about that, because your political awareness might be low for all sorts of reasons. What about these passages in the Bible? See, for Christians, something then happens for us that then changes everything, that mixes all of that up. Whatever we've got politically, this really starts to affect it. We hear firstly, and I put these passages on page 3, in the outline, we hear firstly that God raised Christ from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly realms, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion and every title that can be given, not only in the present age but also in the one to come. And God placed all things under his feet. I mean, that sounds really like quite a lot of political authority for Jesus Christ, doesn't it? Yet we also hear these moments in Scripture when it's okay, when it seems okay to roll with those human authorities that we mentioned. So passage number 2, this famous moment when these folks come to Jesus and say, is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we? Jesus knew their hypocrisy. Why are you trying to trap me? He asked. Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. They brought the coin. And he asked them, whose portrait is this? And whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then Jesus said to them, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Now, the more I look at this passage, the more I realise I think it actually has several layers. On the surface, it's pretty straightforward. In a sense, he means that if Caesar makes a coin and you use it, because part of these people's hypocrisy, they're trying to act like they're setting themselves apart from the whole Roman thing, but there they are with the Roman coins jingling in their pockets, right? So he immediately nails that. And he seems to be saying, well, if Caesar makes a coin and you use it, we'll cooperate. Give him back his little coins when he asks for them. No big deal. You can't complain about Caesar's tax if you're using the very coinage that gave you in everyday life. And so at the same shallow level, it could also mean, well, give to God what is God's. It could simply mean that they should pay their temple tax and make their sacrifices. As if there is a simple divide in life between secular and sacred authority. But Jesus never lives like that, as if half his life can be Caesar's and half God's. Caesar's little coin has Caesar's little image, but people are God's own image. And so at a deeper level, Jesus seems to be saying, give your very selves to God, not to Caesar. Caesar can never own you. Now, the disciples seem to get both sides of this eventually. They seem to get the cooperate bit and the Caesar never owns you bit. Because on the one hand, Peter picks up the cooperative side of the equation when he says, well, submit to every human authority because of the Lord, whether to the emperor as the supreme authority or to governors as those sent out by him to punish those who do what is evil and to praise those who do what is good. Actually, that word authority, every human authority, is a slightly naughty translation. In the original, it says every human creation, actually. Very interesting phrase. Every human creation. It is as if Peter is shrugging a little bit and saying, look, humans come up with all sorts of crazy ways to run themselves. Just roll with it. They dream up all kinds of stuff, just like Aristotle found. And Christians actually like being cooperative. It's interesting that we can cooperate with every human creation. Why? It says because of the Lord. Something in the lordship of Jesus means that you can go along with most any human organisation. Because of the Lord, you get to be the best friend of anybody in management, backing their plays to praise what is good or punish or prevent evil. It really is a wholesome sense in that verse 14 that the best kinds of authority set the conditions for people to prosper. Good, evil. They set the conditions for people to prosper. And of course you can go along with that, not because the authority owns you, but because of the Lord, because that authority is acting in line with your Christian identity. And by the way, I think it straightforwardly follows from this passage that because of the Lord, you would oppose an authority that punished good and praised evil. Thankfully, though, that's relatively uncommon. But Peter famously encounters one of these uncommon moments in that next passage in his own life when he has to give to God what is God's. Let me read this one to you. "We gave you strict orders not to teach in his name," the high priest said. "Yet you have filled Jerusalem with your teaching and are determined to make us guilty of this man's blood." Peter and the other apostles replied, "We must obey God rather than men. The God of our fathers raised Jesus from the dead, whom you had killed by hanging him on a tree. God exalted him to his own right hand as Prince and Saviour, that he might give repentance and forgiveness of sins to Israel. We are witnesses of these things, and so is the Holy Spirit, whom God has given to those who obey him." So even while he's refusing to cooperate, he gives the very teaching that the high priest says not to. This moment signals how what we might call freedom of speech, the freedom to express what God has revealed to these Christians, becomes political bedrock for Christians in every generation since. We'll simply never, ever stop doing that for anyone. Well, we might stop because we're weak and scared, don't get me wrong, I mean that happens all the time, but there will never be any human authority whose authority extends to silencing us. It just doesn't work that way. The other famous text that's really shaped Christians is that one I'm sure you know about, Romans 13. "Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except which God has established." The authorities that exist have been established by God. "Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from the one in authority? Then do what is right, and he will commend you." There's that emphasis again that those in authority are generally on the side of just making it so people can prosper. Popping up again in verse 3. "For he is God's servant to do you good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. He is God's servant, an agent of wrath, to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also because of conscience. This is why you pay taxes. For the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing." Now, because this passage so strongly emphasises cooperation, some Christians have just never ever disobey someone in political power in any circumstance. And so because of this, other people read this passage and have a problem with it because they take it that Paul is not leaving any room for dissent, as it were. I believe this passage needs to be read alongside the other passages in the Bible in this area. It's interesting to see the same stress on paying taxes in verse 6 that Jesus began with. The early Christians just didn't want Jesus' lordship being used as an excuse for not paying your tax, because that's a pretty cheap and tawdry way to get out of paying your tax. And as in Peter's letter, Paul emphasises how these authorities exist to uphold what is right. In verses 3 and 4. So, theoretically, I think that does leave room to question whether it's God who's appointed a ruler who obviously and constantly does wrong. But on the whole, this passage is highlighting how optimistic Christians are about Jesus' rule partly happening on earth through these political authorities. Now, the Bible has several other political passages, but these seem to me to be the Oscar award winners, if you like. These are the go-to passages for Christians thinking about politics. So where does that leave us? We have this political awareness that we grow into to varying degrees. We become aware that Jesus claims us, that we can cooperate with rulers, but that we might sometimes say no. How do Christians pull all that together? Now, there are many ways to answer that question, I guess, and I will try and picture a few different ways in our next sections. But firstly, I just want to read to you this quotation. I actually disagree with the article it came from quite strongly, but I found these few paragraphs capture something quite helpfully. See if they help you. "The degree to which an individual's perception of the world and humanity's place in it are shaped by religion can have profound implications for politics. But to distinguish a relationship in any concrete sense is fraught with problems owing to the lack of conceptual clarity as to what exactly defines the boundaries of the political and the religious. And then these authors go on in the next paragraph to say, look, not only do Christians put things together differently, it's further complicated by the fact that, you know, not everyone's Christians. There's lots of people who believe lots of different things. Here we go. This is further complicated by the complex mix of beliefs in the divine and metaphysical, not all of which recognise a deity as the supreme manifestation of authority and order. Despite the complexity of metaphysical beliefs evident within Australia broadly, it is still possible to discern episodes when religion and politics have been more clearly intertwined. There is a long history of religious influence in Australian politics, particularly in the formation of Australia's two political parties. There is also a long, though contested, tradition of active involvement of mainstream churches and religious leaders in public issues, from opposition to and support for conscription during World War I to recent criticism of the former coalition government's work choices legislation and its treatment of asylum seekers. Mainstream churches have remained politically active, if not always effective. Although there is some debate as to the character and merit of church interventions, it is nevertheless a tradition that has arguably helped strengthen Australia's democratic culture. I think I really like that those few paragraphs, because firstly it just signals that there's been this long history of kind of argy-bargy between Christian people and others. But that if you try and sit down and distill this as a really simple theory of how it works, you're not going to be able to do it, because the boundaries between religious belief and politics are actually quite hard to settle. So after we take pause for questions, I'm going to go on and say a little bit more about what the Christians I know think they're doing. And again, if your head is hurting at this point, just be kind to yourself. This area can be taxing. And keep remembering that politics is basically boils down to working out how to live together as a group. And you probably know a thing or two about that already. What we do, here's a very simple picture of what Christians often do. And like all simple pictures, it can't answer everything, but it'll give us a little bit of a foothold, I think, into what often goes on. And the "we," in inverted commas, covers a lot of people. Might not include you, sorry about that. I'm gesturing in general towards that big sprawling mass out there that we might call the Christian community. And the picture's going to try and get at what a lot of Christians are into politically. So, first, like Peter, before the high priest, we keep putting the case for why we should be free to speak the gospel that others don't always like to hear. And that's our basic condition for blessing the world. Christians can't be anything else in the world if we're not free to speak Christianly about the truth. And so in our context, that goes by these kinds of names: freedom of religion or freedom of religious expression. And in Australia, the most hotly debated areas of this are, firstly, so-called exemptions from anti-discrimination laws. That's an odd one. That sounds like a quite bad thing, as if Christians are being exempted from a good thing to do a bad thing. But these exemptions are the best our polity can come up with to allow so-called faith-based organisations to employ people who will back their Christian identity. So there's this anti-discrimination law that basically says if you're an employer, you just kind of have to employ anyone at all comers on the basis of whether they can do the job or not. But faith-based organisations have this exemption that says if you judge a person isn't going to back your identity as a religious organisation, this anti-discrimination law doesn't apply to you. And secondly, a lot of Christians resist so-called religious anti-vilification law. And again, that sounds like a strange thing to resist. It sounds good law to stop someone from vilifying someone else. But many Christians fear that the devil is in the detail, and that if you try and make a law about how people can speak, it's eventually going to muzzle disagreement and chill robust debate. And so there's a whole bunch of controversies around this area, particularly for, say, faith-based organisations that receive some public funding. So that's every Christian school, many Christian hospitals. And what about when there's religious expressions that already go on in public, in public places like SRE in schools? So in a sense, let's call that first circle the circle of concern where we're wrestling with how free Christians can be. These manoeuvres, these discussions can look very self-serving, can't they? And I have to admit, they can easily become so. But at their best, they are actually supposed to be, the fights in this area are supposed to be expressions both of love for God and love for our neighbour, because we think that our neighbours actually need the truth that we have to share, even if they don't always like hearing them. So that's what I call the freedom circle. And then there's the no circle. These areas of life where people want to do something that we're sure is going to hurt us as a group. Again, at our best, we're saying no to bad ideas in order to love our neighbour. And there are some classics that Christians are often into here. I don't use this word sanctity myself, but others do. So sanctity of life. Christians often find themselves opposing novel so-called bioethics, e.g. early term or late term or so-called post-birth abortion, which is just a fancy name for infanticide. And the other end of life, Christians are often opposing euthanasia law because they think it threatens to put the power to kill in human hands is very risky business. What we might call sanctity of the family, where Christians will oppose prostitution or easy divorce or same-sex marriage. Or on another track, advocacy for the vulnerable, challenging harsh asylum policy or crime and punishment policy or advocating for Indigenous health. Let's just take that discussion about same-sex marriage. I think Christians know we might not be able to stop people because it means so much to them. It's come to mean so much to them, this matter. It symbolises their equality and their love, and that's a very powerful force in their life. But even so, that doesn't alter that there has always been this other way of living that interweaves gender complementarity and exclusive lifelong loyalty and procreation, with sexuality serving all of those three. And up to date, we've called this other way of living marriage. Marriage has been regarded as an honourable way to live and something that serves society well. But marriage has actually been under siege for a long time now, not just lately, for a very long time. It's been under siege with easy divorce. It's been under siege with alternative modes of conception that are now available to every woman. And it's been under siege since we've been saying for the last 40, 50 years that sexuality can be done by anyone and without reference to children. Now, Christians who oppose same-sex marriage believe that you besiege it again if you now say that gender has nothing to do with it. You'll simply be saying that any two people can call themselves married without reference to sexual exclusivity or lifelong faithfulness or child-wearing, and we won't have a name for that old way of being married, and we'll have yet more children with no experience of being fathered or mothered, or even of knowing, possibly in some cases, their biological parents. And we're simply saying back to the society, are you sure you want all this? Are you sure that's what you want? We're not saying no because, you know, we're bastards. We're saying no because we care about you. We think you're going after a bad idea. But even if we're wrong, I wish people would hear this and go, maybe they care for us, even if we don't like what they're saying. And that's what I think Christians are sometimes doing in this no circle. There is a problem, though. When this is all Christians do, when Christians only ever say no and claim for freedom, we look self-serving and we look like bastards because we're opposing ultimately what somebody wants. So there has to be this third circle of Christian political activity when we say yes to society by helping them in areas where people are stuck for ideas. And then it becomes believable to say that we do this because we care for others. We say yes to society when we offer better ideas for how to live together as a group. But unless I'm missing something, I think Australian Christians have become very poor at this. We have largely stopped as a Christian community doing this third thing, the statement of ways of living together that no one has thought of, but that we know because they arises from the gospel. There's a really good example of this in the UK by some people who run something called the Relationships Foundation. I quite like them, a fellow called Michael Schluter, the Relationships Foundation. They read their Bible, they see that in the Old Testament, actually there's lots of laws that finally are there to foster good relationships in that ancient Israelite society. And they try and re-engineer stuff out of these laws and take it back to UK society and say, look, actually, this big organisation that you're running to try and help people, the NHS, say, the National Health Service, their hospital system, it's great you're trying to help people. It's really broken because you've got bad relationships in this organisation. Let us show you how you can have better relationships and so help people more. It's a really interesting example of Christians offering a constructive way ahead to their community in order to care for them. Maybe an example in our context might be something like this. There's those websites, NDIS and NDS are going to take you into something called the National Disability Insurance Scheme. You've heard of this? This is a new idea where everybody contributes to help pay for disability insurance. So if you're born with a disability or if you acquire a disability later in your life, a bit like Medicare, there'll be assistance for you. You'll be able to not let this, because at the moment being a person with disability is incredibly difficult because you just never know whether there's going to be any government support for you or not. So the National Disability Insurance Scheme is trying to even the playing field and make it that anybody who gets a disability has this help. And everybody really likes this idea, except there's just one problem. Can't pay for it. It's too expensive. Christians could very easily get in front of this and go, look, we actually are pro-taxes. Taxes are great because they're a civil way of helping your neighbour. We could take that discussion into a direction that stops people saying, taxes just legalise theft because I want to spend what I want to spend. We could turn that discussion into, how about paying a little bit more tax so that we've all got this organised way of sharing. Such a simple thing to do. Help lead the community to give the politicians permission to raise a new tax, which is the last thing politicians can ever do on their own. One last thing to say on this matter, though, coming up with new ideas, not always that easy. Christians can underestimate the struggle of thinking through policies that work. For example, there's been this whole discussion around the New Start allowance. Now, last year, the federal government moved 39,000 people off the single parent allowance, the allowance that was given to single parents, onto the New Start allowance, amid much controversy because you get paid a lot less on New Start. Now, in a sense, you might go as a Christian, oh, come on, that's rough. That's really hard on the vulnerable. Bring back the parent allowance. It turns out, though, that some 4,000 people have gone on to get employment, which is precisely the government's intention. We don't know exactly the causes for that. We don't know all of the, if it's directly a result of this change in policy, but there it is. There's now 4,000 people in jobs that weren't. So was tough love the right thing here? It's a very complex question. The simple impulse to pay people more might deserve some scrutiny. All that said, there's probably a case for raising New Start just a little bit, even if not to the same level as the old allowance. But I just raised that cameo as an example of, if you get into this, don't always assume that your first thought is the only thought. There's sometimes some complexity to it that needs to be discerned. Saying yes means putting forward considered policy proposals, which takes a bit of expertise, and we don't always have people with those skills, but I'm going to go on to say later how some of us might attain those skills. Styles of engagement. This is just something I've noticed over the years. Four kinds of approaches that Christians seem to have coalesced into to government. And the first I call translation, which converses with government. On this view, government should be religiously neutral, shouldn't play favourites about any religion or any non-religion. And Christians are in the business of translating our concerns into others' concerns. So we find language that isn't Christian language, talk sense to people that don't believe as we do. Now, suppose my typical example here is human rights. Human rights talk has become a way to speak about the preciousness of others, whom Christians believe to be in God's image, but we can shortcut, we do an end run around that theology, around the theology that gives us that knowledge, and assert the point using a term that has become common. I threw in another word there, accommodationism. That's a kind of a swear word that's used by people who don't like this. It's used to accuse these people of giving away the family jewels, as it were. They never talk about Christ and they just go with the flow. That might not always be fair, but that's the kind of rock that gets chucked. The next one, demarcation. Demarcation does a different thing. It asserts cultural space under government. So on this view, governments are going to be very various. They'll be good, they'll be bad, they'll be indifferent, we don't really know. But what do Christians do is demarcate Christians' concerns versus other concerns. So, for example, we might say that churches are in charge of preaching the gospel while governments are in charge of public transport. So we'll have a lot to say about the Bible, but we'll probably oppose any Christian who claims there's some Christian view for or against a high-speed train to Canberra or not, because that's just not our job. Demarcation. Now, that's easy. I picked a deliberately silly example, Bible trains, but of course it gets messy in some areas, doesn't it? Try talking about education and seeing if demarcation works. Try talking about caring for the poor. And in both cases, it becomes a lot harder to demarcate whose job is which. But nevertheless, there's a lot of Christians who try and function like this. embodiment. This is the one that's actually come up a little bit already. These are Christians who just decide to stand aside from government. Government is just not their job. Again, governments will be various, sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes indifferent. Never mind, we simply live out Christian concerns in our own way, true to our own identity, come what may. And so, an example, we might form organisations like schools, hospitals, or monasteries that never accept any government funding, which never send people to war, just don't get involved, as it were, in the activities of government. We might object to paying taxes towards some causes. We might passively resist if someone comes to arrest us. We just don't buy into the political debates that the wider community has about how society should be run beyond the church. This sometimes attracts the swear word quietism, swear word used by those who value political engagement against those who don't. And actually, you could also accuse demarcationists of a kind of quietism, since they'll tend only to weigh into political debate when the demarcation is under threat. So I'd call that semi-quietism, semi-cute. The second, third one again, third one, fourth one. Restoration. The restorationists
assert authority over government. They say that governments should be Christian in a real and observable sense, and it's their task to re-establish Christians' concerns to, as it were, become other people's concerns. I put as an example there something we might call Christian heritage. It's a slightly confusing example, but let's just go with it. We might argue that this nation was formed on Christian principles, and then call others to hold to those principles. So what matters in the Bible, such as the avoidance of the big three, the avoidance of sexual immorality, avoidance of greed, the avoidance of idolatry, should somehow find expressions in the law of the land. Now, that term Christian heritage can be a little confusing because some might hold, as I do, that Australia has a partly Christian heritage and it has other strands in it as well. And it might not, and I don't actually think that restorationism follows. Theocracy is the swear word that gets chucked at this one, the hogeyman word that that these Christians want everybody to be ruled by their God or else. That's possibly not a fair claim against these people, but there it is. Over the page, for my part, just to telegraph what I think, because you're going to ask me, so I'm going to jump in. I'd argue the case for a modified mix of translation and demarcation. This is just today's theory. I go all over the shop on this, so it depends on which day you get me. Anyway, but today I'm arguing for a modified mix of translation and demarcation, and these are the modifications. Firstly, that we should encourage Christians to become engaged in the machinery of politics as their daily work, by which I mean find jobs that actually get you into this space, in order to become people who professionally say yes through better formed policy proposals. Because as it stands, Christians are often doing this from the sidelines. Well, the people who are actually officers in government are just doing the work, you know, so go and do the work. Why not? Secondly, we should insist that Christians shouldn't always have to hide how some of our knowledge arises from the Bible. I don't think it's fair that we're consistently required never to bring the way Scripture has formed us into our discussions of how we think groups should work. But we would accept the need to persuade enough others of our view for it to be enacted as a law, or a policy. We talked about this last year at CCL. That would actually be a useful talk to go on and listen to next. Degrees of involvement that you might consider in order of increasing action. As I talked to my friends about where you might be at tonight, one of them reminded me of just how futile and tiny our beginnings seem to be. So, you know, you cast your vote and then you don't even think about it for 4 years. You click on a Facebook petition or you click a like on someone's page, you know. I mean, what more could... Is that it? Is there any more to it than that? How do you get engaged? And how do you get engaged without having to become one of those scary, exhausting people that we meet? Well, quietism. I suppose that before anything else, actually, you'd have to decide for or against quietism. And people actually have many reasons for quietism. They simply don't know where to begin. And they don't know enough to know how to argue things. And all their friends are quietists. And they have so many responsibilities already in their life that they cannot take on this form of loving their neighbour that we call political engagement. Or they're at some quite dark or hard times in their life. There's lots of forces that might propel you into quietism, and I don't think we should accept that it's just always bad.
many, many understandable forces at work. But unfortunately, sometimes there are these times and places in human history that leave quietists looking morally culpable. So Rwanda in the 90s, pre the genocide, or Germany in the 30s, pre Hitler. There were many points at which, before Hitler got power, Christians could have raised a storm against him. South Africa during apartheid, and maybe even this country in Australia in the 20s, pre the stolen generations. While we can really often easily spot those times and places in human history where Christians stopped loving their neighbour and caring, we can be pretty easy on ourselves about the same thing. Quietism can become an excuse for not caring, and all I ask is for you to interrogate if you've just stopped caring about your neighbour's good. And if you have, then I actually can't fix that here. That's a spiritual and psychological problem, and you'd need to address that in other ways. And it doesn't even follow that if you do love some of your neighbours that you have to get politically engaged, because there are many ways to love them. But I suggest that political engagement can be a way of loving your neighbour. So you've got to make a decision about quietism. Secondly, inform. Let's say that you're not content with quietism, but you're not quite sure what to do next. Well, I think you'd be honourable if you spent 3 or 5 or 10 years just becoming more informed in some areas, even if that didn't translate into action. Because Australians are actually a very politically under-informed people. It's not just Christians, it's Australians. We find it hard to think straight about anything. And we're such an anxious and brittle lot that we cannot have a sane discussion about anything much. You know, and the only antidote to that is knowledge. And when I don't know anything about anything, what I do is I just dive in. And I always believe the first thing I read. I mean, I'm just hopeless. I always believe the first thing I read. But over time, what happens? You start comparing arguments. You start finding information and facts and so on. So I'd suggest just dive in. Start with opinion pieces and blogs and opinions in news sites, but then go beyond them. So I've listed a few places. There's this marvellous site called The Conversation, and it gives unmediated access to academic experts in all sorts of different areas. You might not agree with them. They're all coming from an agenda, but you're getting them unmediated by the media. Same also with this slightly more technical site, Australian Policy Online. If you want to dive into what the left says, there's some sites from the left of the political spectrum and also some sites from the right. If you want to go hardcore, get into the various government reports that they pay megabucks to produce and nobody reads. It's really sad. They're really detailed and interesting. Well, not always interesting, but they're detailed. And I didn't give any websites for those because unfortunately they're sort of scattered across all the arms of government and they're everywhere. But that's where you can really, if you get interested in something, that's where you go. And, you know, don't be daunted by the hundreds of issues that people are discussing out there. Just dive in on one or two that intrigue you. And, you know, over time, pretty quickly, actually, you'll find yourself becoming a little bit expert in it. And after a while, you'll find yourself wanting to inform and correct others, and you'll find yourself writing intelligent things in blogs and in comments on blogs and in letters to the media. It'll kind of bubble up out of you easily because you've got something to say and it's worth saying. So even that being informed task is an honourable activity. What about the next one, activism or advocacy? Well, a simple way to become active is on an ad hoc basis and as time permits. There are all these government inquiries going on all the time, and I've been really surprised by this. Long before they get to the state of making and passing a law, there's panels of people calling for submissions for the entire Australian populace. Tell us what you think about this thing. And they have to accept what you think. They have to accept your submission, and they have to read it. And they, and I've been surprised, I've only sort of got into this just in a little way in the last 10 years, but I've been surprised that on occasion you really actually will find members of Parliament, sort of in this quiet back room where the stakes are much lower and there's no media rights, they give you a fair hearing. They're intrigued by your view. They're actually, you know, well upstream from when the thing is public and the law is at stake. Often politicians are trying to get it right. Like the Bible says, they're trying to work out what's good and stop what's bad, you know. And when Christians are in that phase of the operation, they're genuinely curious about our view. And I think it's just an opportunity that just goes begging all the time because so few citizens know about it. It would also be interesting to see more Christian membership in political parties or in active lobby groups, and I've listed some from the Christian right and the Christian left and some other another right and left organisation there. Now, I don't say that lightly. I know that it's hard to become that focused, to join up with a group,
And of course, you may have heard some of these organisations are not like what they do, but in a sense, that's the whole point of your joining. After you've become informed enough to gain credibility, you can argue for things to be done differently. Christians always have this nutty view that a Christian worldview is like a silver bullet, that we can just say it and we'll slay everyone with its obviousness and they'll all be with us. And then we get disappointed when this doesn't happen and we walk away. We've actually been delusional in this, because that's never the way it works in big groups of people. Change in groups can only happen in tiny increments over decades. And the people who have made the biggest changes in our society have made them in tiny increments over decades, and usually through groups like the ones that I've listed. And we Christians simply get what we pay for in this regard. We can't complain about how they all run this wider group called Australia if we're never at the table learning and growing and pushing for change. Simple as that. Get what you pay for. Finally, public life. Being a senator or an MP, or standing for office for those, or being a councillor, or becoming a public intellectual, someone who thinks about stuff and talks about it, or having a career in the public service, which is involved in policy formation, well, these are you know, actual jobs that people can do, and that you might do, perhaps. Because in principle, they open public life to all comers. And I don't think we're at a state in this country where Christians are somehow prejudiced against in public life, maybe in some pockets, but you know, most of the time, if you can do the job, you're welcome. And that's what they mean by democracy. It's open to all comers. Those in public life get to say what others have missed and push for changes. Now, I guess there's two questions you'd have to ask before you did that. Can you extend to it? I think a few people can do a good job of public life if they have to care for someone, like small children or person with a disability or mental illness, or if they have their own chronic condition. There's just some people who you can't do this because it's a stretching kind of work. You're wired for it. Public life is really adversarial. Discussions get into conflict really fast. You can't be second-guessing your position when you're in the thick of it in the arena. And that's why, as far as I can tell, people in public life are always folks with a personality that is very serenely stubborn. You usually cannot dissuade them from their course or from their view. And if you could, they wouldn't be much of a leader. And that's why if you strongly disagree with them, all you can do is publicly oppose them, which brings us back to that adversarial conflict. So it seems to me that it's a life for people who can be stubborn and who can weather conflict, and it probably means you're the firstborn in your family. I put a little smiley in my notes as I said that.